Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the March 1st broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Italian Tomatoes. It is Sunday, March 1st. I'm your host, Bob Curie, and I open the show with a little bit of an opera piece from the opera Nabucco, which is opera, that's the ballad of the Hebrew slaves exiled in Babylon, mourning the loss of their homeland, and it seemed to be an appropriate tie-in for what looks like will be a very dramatic week in Washington, D.C., when the Prime Minister of Israel comes with a lot of historical memories to address the U.S. Congress about a looming danger to the State of Israel from the nuclear weapons program or alleged nuclear weapons program of Iran. Of course, Iran denies it, and the Obama administration is doing its best to try to downplay the Iranian nuclear threat, but a lot of people aren't buying it and do believe that the Iranian state is pursuing nuclear weapons, and God only knows what they would do with them once they have them. So that's kind of the backdrop of today's this week's political scene. The title of the show is The Presidential Season Begins. We're going to talk a little bit about the upcoming presidential campaign, but first some administrative notes. The chat is open if you wish to participate in the chat. And to call into the show, the number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. Don't know what kind of live participation we'll have tonight. It's pretty lousy weather in a great deal of the country, and I always get a kick out of these winter storms because of the tie-in with global warming, which tickles my funny bone at least. We had very bad weather in the Dallas-Fort Worth area here this past week, big ice storm on Monday, snow, sleet, and ice again on Friday. And, of course, the northern parts of the country have been getting hammered pretty relentlessly this winter. So the rising seas of global warming seem to be a distant threat right now, but that's a subject we'll revisit at another time. Some personal notes. In the past couple of years after I retired from American Airlines, I have been working in tax preparation on a sort of full-time, part-time basis. I'm taking some time off for some medical procedures. I have a couple of cataract-related procedures on my eyes coming up, and I'm devoting some time to all my different medical issues, which have been piling up over the years. And also moving a little bit more into, retirement mode as I progress into my sexagenarian years, as I like to call them. One thing I've learned from doing the tax work is the absolute quandary a lot of people are finding themselves in from the Affordable Care Act. The provisions of the law are very complicated. There's a confusing array of tax penalties and exemptions from tax penalties. And the tax penalties can come and bite people of very modest incomes. And what happened was during the fiasco of the open enrollment season in late 2013, early 2014, a lot of people simply just gave up trying to enroll. And of course, now that they're doing their taxes, they find themselves in a position where they could be hit with tax penalties for not having insurance for the whole year. And those tax penalties can bite at people with very modest incomes. And to me, the whole ACA situation is an illustration of the central trend of our federal government in the past few years under this current administration, and to a lesser degree under Bush. It just gets bigger and more intrusive every passing year, and yet it becomes less effective. And I think that is an interesting backdrop to the presidential season that is approaching, and that will be a theme for this show and future shows. So I'm going to check my chat, make sure no one needs attention. Everything looks good there and in the, and on the phones. So I'll go through my prepared remarks. If we have participation tonight, once I finish the prepared remarks, we'll take calls and respond to anything that comes up in the chat. And if there's very little activity there, we'll call it a night. I thought to kick off the start of our presidential politics discussion, I thought it would be interesting to go across the pond. I'm a bit of an Anglophile, and I like to get insights about politics in general by looking at them in another country. And the country that is kind of my preferred visitation point is Great Britain. Great Britain is going to have a general election in May of 2015, which itself looks to be quite interesting, and I might look at that in another show just devoted to that in a few months. I think the election is scheduled in May. But it's always good to look at politics in another country because you can analyze it more objectively. I mean, after all, even as close as the ties are culturally between Britain and the U.S., it is a separate country with very distinct political traditions that are different than ours. So it's kind of a way to analyze politics without getting overly emotionally engaged in it because it's not our country. And so I find that kind of a fruitful exercise. So I'm going to play a theme song from a very witty television series done about, I think, about 15 years ago or so, maybe a little more than that, called House of Cards, about a unscrupulous but extremely determined prime minister and his rise to the top of British politics, a guy, Francis Urquhart, for whom the end always justified the means. So first I'll play the theme show for the song, for the show, and then we'll then I have another clip I want to play related to House of Cards. So here is the theme song. Now, the premise of the show has to do with the rise of Francis Urquhart to the top of the British political ladder and the techniques, scrupulous and unscrupulous, mainly the latter, that he used to get there. And the show is kind of based loosely on the British political scene in the late 90s after the departure of Margaret Thatcher, and the lead character, Francis Urquhart, displaces a prime minister who is widely perceived to be genial but ineffective, and the character is somewhat loosely modeled on John Major. So as he's plotting his palace coup, he has an aside where he's talking to the audience, which I think is kind of funny. And here that goes.
Not feeling guilty, I hope. If you have pangs of pity, crush them now. Grind them under your heel like old cigar butts. I've done the country a favor. He didn't have the brain or the heart or the stomach to rule a country like Great Britain. A nice enough man, but there was no bottom to him. His deepest need was that people should like him. An admirable trait, that, in a spaniel or a whore. Not, I think, in a prime minister. And we've done him a favor, too, if you did but know it. He was in the trap and screaming from the moment he took office. We've simply put the poor bastard out of his agony. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. So let's not indulge ourselves in any squeamishness. All right? Because this is just the start. You saw them. You saw their eyes aglitter round the table. Samuels, Wilton, Harold L., Mackenzie. And every one of them will have to understand that I have their measure, that I put the stick about. I watch them jump.
Well, the people that Francis Urquhart is talking about are his potential rivals for the party leadership spot. And the show is very entertaining about the various strategies that are used, that he uses to undermine them. And I think it's a good lead-in to the discussion of presidential politics in the U.S. because, I mean, obviously, the presidency is just an enormously important office. And we have to be realistic as conservatives or small government believers about politics. Politics can be a very rough and tumble business, full of surprises, unfair things, dirty tricks. And there is also a very long vetting process that goes on with presidential candidates. And, of course, if you're a Republican, we have the added disadvantage of the overt, often overt, and always covert hostility of the national media, which most voters have to rely on to get informed about on the political scene. The presidential season is a long rehearsal period where various candidates take their cases to the public, and we get to test them out in a variety of ways. We get to see how they interact with ordinary voters, with the media, when controversies arise, when their policies are attacked, when they don't have a policy and are called on it. It's very much a session of political theater. And I thought it would be kind of interesting to draw a contrast between the political theater of the U.S. presidential season and the actual theater of the theater business. And again, you know, succumbing to a little Anglophilia here, I came across a clip of a very famous British actress, Diana Rigg, who many people might remember of a certain age, was absolutely famous as Mrs. Peel of the Avengers television series, and then went on to become a Bond girl in one of the James Bond's films, and then had just an enormously successful career on film and on stage, and she was knighted by the Queen for her services to her profession. So Diana Rigg has some interesting things to say about the rehearsal period in theater, and I think there's a good parallel between that and the rehearsal period that we're going to go through on the political scene. So I'm going to play a clip or two of that. So here she is.
What do you get from a rehearsal period? What do you get from the director?
A great deal. I love the rehearsal period. It's my favorite time. I like playing, of course, but the rehearsal period is a time when you can examine everything. You can experiment wildly, throw the net of choice, of option on a part, very wide indeed. And then as the rehearsals progress, you distill down and down and down.
What is acting? What happens when you're acting?
I'd prefer to take that question from the other side. When the audience comes to the theater, they come to believe. They make an act of belief. They pay their money and sit in their seats and are prepared to believe. And you, as an actor, have to answer that belief as best you can, as truthfully as you can, in the part that you're playing. So it's a process of finding the truth within the character and playing that so that the belief is sustained.
The audience to believe.
I think that's a very interesting way of putting the challenge that an actor has in playing a part and making it believable. And I think there's a parallel between that and a politician who's trying to present a vision to the voters that has to be believable in order to be successful. And that is one of the, that, to me, I think that's the absolute key test of a successful contender in the presidential primaries. Is the guy or woman believable or not? You know, we all know about politicians who will say anything to pacify an audience, but I think people underestimate the skill of the voters in deciphering what's believable and what is not believable, what is credible and what is not credible, what is an authentic vision of the future for a country, and what is just a collection of promises to pacify different parts of a political coalition. And that, to me, is the most important part of the vetting process that's going to go on. But in addition to that, we need to focus on the role of political advisors, because that was also a big issue in the presidential campaign of Mitt Romney, where there just didn't seem to be a central vision of what Romney was going to do for the country. I think partly that was because of media bias, but partly Romney wasn't all that comfortable about projecting believability, and I don't think he was well served by his advisors when it came to projecting a vision and a sense of believability. So there is a parallel, in my view, between political advisors in the political realm and the role of directors in the theatrical realm. And Diana Rigg goes into that a little bit. And so this is my last clip of her, which is about a minute long. And let's get it rolling.
Before you get onto the stage with the audience, what do you get from a director? What does he or she contribute?
Well, he's objective for a start, and that is very important. Otherwise, you can dig yourself really deep into a part. He can say, no, 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 pull back on that, push on that. He orchestrates. But he also, he can help you in the process of discovery. He is a different person, after all, or she, and is seeing it a different way. And he can put different points to you that you may be missing.
I think that is really a very good explanation of what a good political advisor does, because in addition to the nitty-gritty of daily politics, he has to help a candidate project that air of believability and also keep the candidate from getting too bogged down in minutiae at the expense of the larger vision. And that is a tough road to walk, and I think we need to really respect the craft of political advisors when they really do serve the country well in helping a candidate articulate a believable vision. I'm going to go check my studio and switchboard, see if anything needs attention. Looks okay. So now, what is the kind of framework that we're going to face in the coming election season? I have a clip from Dick Morris, which I think is really spot on in terms of gauging the political environment that we find ourselves in. My own view is that the backdrop of this election is crisis management. Foreign policy is a mess. We have a very aggressive Iran, and I've already alluded to the nuclear controversy concerning Iran and the threat that it may represent to Israel. You have a very expansive and aggressive Russia, which has had outright invasion of parts of a sovereign country, being the Ukraine. You have the absolute fiasco that unraveled in the Middle East with the collapse of the Iraqi government in the face of the ISIS offensive, the spread of ISIS, the degree to which it uses terror and murder and intimidation to enforce its authority in the areas that are unfortunate enough to become controlled by it, the absolute ruthlessness of ISIS in terms of punishing enemies through decapitations or burning or whatever. And then, of course, you have the total fiascos in Syria and in Libya and the alienation of Egypt from the United States because Obama became too cozy with the Muslim Brotherhood government there. The Egyptian army and people had enough and threw the brothers out. And we have a situation now where Egypt, which had been a staunch ally of the United States for over 30 years, the relationship between America and Egypt is at a low point because of what they perceive to be the disastrous intervention of Barack Obama and his State Department in the internal affairs of their country. On the economic front, we have a very sluggish economy. We have staggering debt at the federal level. No one knows whether we can fund ourselves through another downturn when we have already amassed close to $20 trillion in debt. We have chronic structural unemployment that has been masked by the media and by the government through clever manipulation of statistics, but when you dig a little bit beneath those statistics, you get a very depressing picture of stagnant incomes against large structural unemployment and underemployment. And as far as the impact on minorities, especially African Americans, and also on young people, the current economy is terrible. It is terrible. It's probably the worst in 40 years. The last part of the political backdrop are the constitutional issues, which are moving to the forefront in a way that we haven't seen since the Nixon days and the Watergate scandal. You have the constant expansion of government power on a whole range of things, from amnesty to gun control, to abuse of the IRS, to net neutrality. The executive branch is constantly trying to implement a policy without getting legislative approval for that policy, and I think that trend is going to intensify during the final 2 years of the presidency. And so this is the environment that our presidential contenders are going to sally forth into the public square and try to deal with it. So now I'm going to play this video from Dick Morris, who has, you know, I believe Dick Morris is a very skillful observer of the political scene, and he has in one of his lunch alert videos, a little blurb called "What's Ahead for the 2016 Republicans?" And it's got some good insights there, so I'm going to play that.
The shape of the 2016 presidential race is beginning dimly to come into view, at least on the Republican side, Democratic side of Hillary. And I'd like to share that emerging view with you. There are really these days three power centers in the Republican Party, namely the financial power centers. One is the Bush organization, the Bush money machine, that has gotten into high gear for the father and for George W. Bush, and now is gearing up for Jeb Bush. It's enormous, and it can probably raise upwards of $1 billion. The second power center is centered around the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H. David and Charles Koch have amassed a very strong organization of rich people who are determined, largely for patriotic reasons, to save the United States. And with very little or any self-interest involved, they have given freely of their fortunes to try to stop what Obama is doing to this country. A lot of the victory in 2010 and 2014 is attributable to the Koch financial influence. Now, the Koch brothers don't give it all their own money. There's a whole network that they tap into, including some relatively small donors. But it has a lot to do with the Tea Party and a lot to do with the whole movement of economic conservatism. Not that the Tea Party is funded by them, but that it's a similar group. And through an organization called Americans for Prosperity, working with the Tea Party, they kind of provide the ground forces that underscore a lot of the Koch initiatives. So that's kind of the second power center. The third power center are the evangelicals, who are separate. Most of the Tea Party people are evangelical. Very few of the wealthy Bush donors are evangelical. And they have sort of their own organization, their own fundraising stream, and their own candidate. Well, at the moment, it's looking, of course, that Jeb Bush will run and will be the candidate of the Bush machine. Now, the Koch organization could support any one of a number of candidates. There are 8 or 9 of them that are appropriately conservative, appropriately honest, and would satisfy the highly patriotic motivation behind the Koch brothers and their people. But the one that seems to be emerging from the pack is Scott Walker. They like his record as governor. They like that he's independent. They like that he has a pre-existing financial organization based on the huge amount he was able to raise in his 2 election campaigns and in fighting the recall campaign that the unions mounted against him. They love his record of standing up to labor, and he meets all the other credentials as a conservative. I don't think that that's a hard and fast decision by them. They could still be with Ted Cruz. They probably could not be with Rand Paul because of his foreign policy stuff, and too many of their people are national security types that would abhor that. They could still be for Marco Rubio. They could still be for John Kasich or Jindal. But I think at the moment, Walker is clearly out in front. And then you have the evangelicals, who are probably going to reject Rick Santorum and instead choose Mike Huckabee, who was their favorite in 2008. Now, Huckabee firmly rejects the ghettoization of being the evangelical candidate. He'll use them to get to the dance, but once he's at the dance, he's going to dance to the beat of his own independent drummer and talk about issues that are not evangelical, but that relate to income inequality and a host of other areas. And there is a populist tinge to Huckabee's rhetoric and Huckabee's approach, reminiscent in a sense of some of the left wing on Occupy Wall Street, against the elites that are running Wall Street, and in his view and mine, really running America into the ground. There's also some chance that he might embrace the convention of states, the idea of having the states meet in a constitutional convention to amend the Constitution without even asking Congress, as permitted by the Constitution, so as to move power away from Washington and back to states and toward the people. So at the moment, it's shaping up as three frontrunners: Bush against Walker against Huckabee. And those are three great candidates. Any one of them would be a fabulous president and a big improvement over Obama. And may the best person win. Thanks for watching.
Okay. Well, I think that is a very, very succinct presentation about the three legs of the stool of the current Republican Party. You have, as Dick Morris describes it, you have Bush and the establishment wing. You have the Tea Party movement and its de facto alliance with the Koch brothers, who are funding a lot of the activist groups that are pushing Tea Party issues: smaller government, less intrusive government, more fiscal responsibility, better national defense posture, etc. And then you have the evangelicals, wherein there is, obviously there is some overlap with the Tea Party there. But, of course, the evangelicals are more attuned to social issues. They probably have a better sense than either of the other two wings of the real economic distress that a lot of Americans are feeling. They are probably more likely to reach lower-income voters than the other two wings of the party. And, of course, there is the always contentious values issues, social issues, which are very interesting to the evangelicals, but leave the establishment cold, and the Tea Party is not that concerned with social issues, although, like I said, there is some overlap between the Tea Party groups and the evangelicals. Jeb Bush is clearly the candidate of the establishment wing. That became very clear when, Mitt Romney was muscled out of his late attraction towards entering the Republican presidential race this season. It looks like a lot of the big money establishment Republican types got together and told him, thanks but no thanks, we're moving on to someone else. If Bush fails, I suspect the establishment will turn to people like Chris Christie or John Kasich, who have track records as governor. Of course, it's debatable what those track records are like, but the establishment wing is going to be looking for executive experience, but executive experience from somebody who is not too intimidating and who scares them with overly ideological approach to politics. So that's kind of my take on where the establishment will go if Jeb Bush falters. As Morris says, the Koch brothers and the Tea Party people seem to be consolidating around Scott Walker, who is also got executive experience that will make him palatable to the establishment. But he also has a track record of taking stands and winning in difficult political circumstances. So that's something that's very attractive to the Tea Party, because the Tea Party is getting very fed up with the perceived spinelessness and ineffectiveness of the current Republican Congress. They want somebody to come in to the executive branch and really make a difference. Now, obviously, the liberals are going to concentrate a lot of fire against Scott Walker. If for some reason he falters, then the next thing that probably what I would think would happen would be a governor that has strong executive presence, strong conservative bona fides, but who doesn't scare the establishment too badly, will come to take his place, and that could be Rick Perry. And then, of course, on the social conservative side, Huckabee has you know, good bona fides as far as being executive. He was governor for Arkansas for 10 years. He obviously has an enormous amount of appeal to social conservatives and to evangelical voters. So he's got a low-key demeanor as far as his personality goes, so he wouldn't scare the establishment too badly. They would scare them a little bit, but not too badly. Now, and if he were to fail, I don't know who would pick up the mantle of the evangelical side of the party. I'm just not that aware of anybody waiting in the wings who could replace him. And then you have what I would call the outliers, candidates who, and they don't really have executive experience, who appeal to various strands of thinking within the Republican Party. You have Ted Cruz, who is, you know, the ideological Tea Party favorite, but without the executive experience that the Tea Party is looking for. You have Rand Paul with his libertarian emphases, which will address an important strand of thinking within the party. You have Marco Rubio with, again, a senator with obvious potential appeal to Latino voters, which is a voting bloc where the Republicans have to make some progress considering the demographic trends in the country. And you have kind of the anti-Obama in Ben Carson, who I think is looking to do a lot of the damage that has been done to the social fabric of America by the constant race baiting of the Obama administration. So all of these candidates, those last four, Cruz, Paul, Rubio, and Carson, have no real executive experience, but they do have a lot of appeal to distinct sets of thinking within the Republican Party. So if for some reason the three major wings can't produce somebody who seems to be able to win it, then there may be opportunities for those guys to make a difference. So that's kind of the end of my prepared remarks. Like I said, this was just an exploratory discussion. I think we'll be doing some political shows over the next few months as that season heats up. The next show I have planned is going to deal with corporate governance, and I hope to have a guest on, and I'll explain that more in, when I do the promotional part for the show. We're going to talk about corporate governance in America and what has happened to the traditional corporate culture as epitomized by big companies such as IBM, which used to be pillars of employment stability, but now have become all wrapped up in the downsizing and restructuring that seems to be so common in the corporate world during the past decade or so. So that's I may also experiment with podcasting where I pre-record a show and then broadcast it with a live chat in the evening. That kind of format is very appealing to me because doing a live show and paying attention to the chat and the phones is kind of daunting, and I'm looking for formats that are easier to produce, so I may be experimenting with that over the next few months. So that's kind of it for now. So I'm going to close, I think, with a I'm trying to think of how I want to close the show, and I think I'm going to show, since I did do British themed clips, I'm going to play British themed clips about why it's important for people to get involved in elections, because if you don't get involved, you wind up living with results that you may not like. And this clip is from the British television series Edward VII, where Edward VII's mother, who is Queen Victoria, is bitching about an election that produced a prime minister that she cannot stand. So I'll close with that.
The prime minister's arrived.
Oh, that dreadful man.
Mr. Gladstone? Oh, come, Mama. He's devoted to you and has a sincere desire to serve you.
So you say. It seems to me a defect in our much-famed constitution to have to lose an admirable government like Mr. Disraeli's for no question of any importance or any particular reason, merely on account of a number of votes. What?
Yes, it must seem very odd.
Farewell, John. Half the time I don't know what Gladstone is talking about. He speaks to me as if he were addressing a public meeting.
Well, that kind of sizes it up, doesn't it? It all comes down to the number of votes, and that's the kind of, whatever those that number of votes says, that's the kind of government we get in the next political cycle. So I hope everybody has had a great, pleasant, and safe weekend, despite the weather. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more commentary on current events. And hope you all have a pleasant and fruitful week. Have a great evening.